Hello and welcome to the very last episode of the Evil in the Stacks podcast. Today's interview is very exciting. It is with Gwendolyn Keist, author of Rust Belt Maidens, Reluctant Immortals, a ton of other pieces, whose archive we also happen to have at Pitt. So I'm going to jump us right into the interview because it is a little long, but definitely worth it. And I want to say thank you to everyone for listening over the course of this year. It's been really fun producing these podcasts, and I hope that Archives and Special Collections has something else exciting in store for you going forward. So thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy. Today we have with us Gwendolyn Keist, who is a spectacular author of horror, in particular. My favorite pieces of hers are female-centered horror. And we also happen to have her archive at Pitt. So we are going to be talking about that and some comics today. I'm going to let her introduce herself in case she has anything on the horizon that's exciting. And then we will take it away. So go ahead, Gwendolyn.
Well, first off, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. But yeah, I'm Gwendolyn Keist. I am a horror author located south of Pittsburgh. My work includes The Rust Maidens, Bone Set and Feathers, Reluctant Immortals. My archive, like you said, is at Pitt, and I'm a three-time Bram Stoker Award winner. So yeah, I'm just very excited to be here and talk about horror.
Amazing. Thank you. So I'm going to start us off with something really, I think, kind of general, but important. The question that kind of always comes to mind first for me when I hear the phrase women in horror, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, is of which women and where in horror. So I'm excited to talk to you because of your positionality as a woman writing about and also with women in the genre. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about the audience that you envision for your books, beyond just a general people interested in the genre, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, like you said, you know, women in horror, we talk about it a lot. There used to definitely be a Women in Horror Month. Now there kind of is. It's sort of like not quite as focused as it used to be, but it is something we talk about a lot in the genre. And like you said, I write about a lot of female characters. And then, you know, I also, you know, work with a lot of women in horror, you know, with anthologies I'm in, and I've done interview series and things like that. So, you know, for me, I really do hope that, you know, my audience either are women readers or are at least supportive of women in horror, right? You know, you hope that people are picking up the books, you know, understand that historically women have not had the same opportunities in the genre or in any genres, really. You know, horror has in some ways been a little bit better for women in terms of character representation. And, you know, you go back to, I feel like she always gets mentioned, but Mary Shelley, you know, obviously kind of an original woman in horror. So we do have a history of representing women in horror, but again, it could be better, right? Like we could have more women in horror, more women writers, more female characters, characters that are represented, you know, in more diverse ways, you know, more women of color, more LGBTQ writers. So yeah, for me, I just really hope that it resonates with readers and that people are thinking about, hey, you know, this is still an ongoing issue. Hopefully we're making it better. Make sure that there's better representation in that regard. And so for me, when I'm writing, I'm hoping that the people who are reading my work, you know, understand that and, you know, are supportive of making horror more diverse. And, you know, it just welcomes in more people. We get more readers. We get more of an audience. It's better for everybody.
Right, exactly. What do you hope your readers, particularly young women, walk away from a text, especially like Reluctant Immortals, which I recently finished reading? But what do you hope that they walk away with? Not necessarily kind of a message, but a feeling or a general sense from the text, if
yeah.
any.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like you said, if any, you know, everybody always say mileage may vary with any kind of art, but For me, it's really about that kind of empowerment, and not empowerment necessarily as a buzzword, because I think empowerment and female empowerment, it can almost be like something that ends up getting just sold to you on like a lunchbox or something is sometimes how, but really this idea of, you know, you can be who you want to be, and, you know, really going with that idea of not allowing other people to define your identity and to define your life for you, and to fight for ways, you know, to make sure we can all be who we are. And because there obviously there's the system in place that doesn't want that. And so, you know, really trying to find those ways through and helping each other in that pursuit. A lot of what my work I feel like is about the sharing of power. It's not necessarily about this one chosen one who's got all of the power. You know, it's much more about trying to share power and say we're better when we all have power, not when just one person has power. That's always bad. Even if, like, you know, at that moment you're like, I like that person. Like, no, it's not good. We, you know, it's really about the sharing of power. And so I think a lot of my work, and Reluctant Immortals in particular, is very much about learning how to share that power and how to hopefully use power in positive ways to empower one another.
So what was kind of behind the choice to not only re-envision the characters in Reluctant Immortals who are from Dracula and Jane Eyre, but like re-envisioning classic horror literature, but specifically doing it in a way where you're picking up characters who are largely just props in their original texts. They move the story along and then they're gone, right? Mm-hmm. They're set dressing almost. So, and more than that, like, why these particular characters? Mm-hmm. You could have chosen any number of maligned, you know, flat, hollow women in horror's past. So why Lucy and Bertha?
So yeah, I very much sadly agree that in the original text, I don't feel like Lucy in Dracula or Bertha in Jane Eyre get nearly enough page time or screen time than in the film adaptations. They're to me the most interesting characters because they have this much more kind of complicated story. They're very much, from what we learn about them, and Bertha, obviously, we don't learn nearly as much about in Jane Eyre. Lucy is in Dracula a decent bit. I agree that she can feel very much like set dressing, and we don't get as much into her character as we do even Mina, or certainly a lot of the male characters. But with Bertha, you know, she's barely on the page. But with both of them, I just felt that they were so interesting, and they were kind of these almost like boundary crossers in a lot of ways. They were really different. They had these different ideas. They didn't go along with what they were told to do in many ways, and then they were punished for it, as often happens in stories and even in horror. You know, you have the characters that break the rules and they don't get to survive. And so that always appealed to me about their characters, and I always wanted to know more about them. And so that was really the main, you know, idea with choosing Lucy and Bertha, who in Reluctant Immortals is called B, in that they were just the ones that had always resonated with me from the time that I was young, and I just wanted to know more about them. And there are lots of other characters that you could include. Originally, I considered including Sybil Vane from The Picture of Dorian Gray, because she kind of fits that same sort of mold, and I ultimately decided against it after talking to my editor, because this book's going to have to be way bigger and way longer. And I'm like, I do want it to be more of a contained story, but there are a lot of different characters that could absolutely be included. And, you know, hopefully someday I will write about Sybil from Dorian Gray, because I love her character too, for the same reason, because I think she's so interesting and she doesn't really get a lot of exploration as to her motives and how she feels, you know, and how that. A lot of times with characters like that, and even people like that, we don't want to hear their point of view. We don't want to get into, you know, it's complicated and it's harder than just these kind of flat, like, oh, here's, we'll make this easy. And it's like, they're more difficult characters. And so for me, that's just the more fascinating story and the story that hasn't been told yet.
One of the things that really resonated for me was this really interesting exploration of trauma, especially around like intimate partner violence and sexual violence and this kind of thing, right? And
I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, especially like around this notion of like the stories we don't get told, right?
Yes. And that's very, it's frustrating, but it's also scary to me how much we don't get a lot of stories from people who have survived these situations, have survived intimate partner violence, domestic violence, childhood abuse. Their stories are often silenced. And then what also happens is you have to basically be a quote unquote good victim. And you have to almost kind of, if you are a survivor and people are going to listen to you, it often has to be that you have to say certain things, that it can only go like, this is how it is. And you have to look a certain way. And, you know, you have to be a certain way. You have to say certain things, and it can't be complicated. And it's like, oftentimes it is. Oftentimes people who are survivors of intimate partner violence have complicated feelings toward their abusers. And that was something that was really important to me when I was writing this, because it's like, we want it to be simple. We want it to be like really easy. Like, oh, well, I just want to kill him, or I just want him gone. And I, you know, it's more complicated than that. And we often don't get that story, because for people who haven't survived those type of situations, they don't understand it, and they kind of don't want to a lot of times, which is very scary to me, because it's like, we tend to normalize the way we look at the world based on people who don't have a lot of trauma. And so everything has to kind of be put through their perspective of like, what can those people who don't have the trauma handle hearing about trauma? And it's like, it really isn't about you. Like, I'm happy for anyone who hasn't been, you know, a victim of these things. I'm very, very glad. I don't want anyone to be, but we shouldn't have to kind of normalize it or alter the script in a way that makes it easier for people who don't have as much trauma in their background. And so that was something I really was thinking about when I was writing Reluctant Immortals, of like making it complicated, like how Lucy feels about Dracula, how Jane and Bertha feel about Rochester. It's not straightforward. It's not easy. And as much as kind of we want it to be as a society, it's not. And that's the reality. And okay, I should say this. Some people, it is easy. And I think the many people who are survivors of intimate partner violence, the further you get out from the situation, a lot of times you do just, I know a lot of people, I know from my own situations, like a lot of times you do hate the person as time goes on. And you can understand, like, once you get that sort of distance, it's a lot easier. But, you know, especially, and sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes there are people who've been out of a situation for 20 years and they're still complicated feelings. But, you know, and so also not saying that any one experience is exactly the same. And that was something I was also trying to do with Reluctant Immortals, because how Lucy feels about Dracula is different than how Jane feels about Rochester, is different how Bertha feels about Rochester. Each of them are at different places in the kind of the way I see it. And this is a little bit of a spoiler, but Jane's still very much in that moment and in that kind of, you know, abuse cycle. Whereas Lucy is a lot more complicated with the way she feels about Dracula. There's an attraction, but she knows he's pretty awful. And then Bertha B just can't stand Rochester, has been out of it long enough, has a very different perspective. So to me, it was kind of about looking at the different ways that people can, you know, the people do cope with abuse, and how it's very different, and it's not like a one size fits all. And that was something I was thinking about a lot when I was writing it.
Yeah. So are you familiar with Jean Reese's White Sargasso Sea? And do you see that text and Reluctant Immortals in conversation at all? And kind of how do you see that relationship?
I do see it as being somewhat in conversation. I didn't go back to White Sargasso Sea. I think I read it many years ago. I didn't want to go back to it. It's obviously not in public domain. So I'm like, I don't want this influencing it at all, but I am obviously aware of it. And so I loved the idea of it. I think it's such an incredible, I remember when I first learned about that there is something from you know, Bertha's perspective, I was very excited. And so I do feel like they're in conversation. You know, mine is more supernatural, so there's that difference. But this idea of saying, you know, that there are different perspectives that we should be looking at stories from. And so I love the concept of it. I mean, of course, you know, I love retellings anyways, but I remember when I was very young, I also heard that there was a play called Renfield that was specifically from Renfield's perspective in Dracula, and I remember being fascinated by that. So it's like, I've always loved those types of types of stories that do that kind of give you that different perspective from somebody who maybe was ignored or only this minor character, and seeing it, you know, how it's different if you see it from another perspective.
Yeah, so like shifting the frame, if we're mm-hmm. thinking in film terms, just taking the shot and moving it a little bit to the right or left. Yeah, exactly. That's, and you do a spectacular job of it with Reluctant Immortals. If you couldn't tell, I'm a fan. Now you know. So I'm gonna bring us back to comics a little bit, as a lot of writing has been done on the history and analysis of especially 1950s comics, which is a lot of what we have in our comics collection at Pitt, and particularly horror, reads intimate partner violence, sexual violence, gendered violence, and just general like cruelty to women and women's bodies in a term that gets picked up from Wortham's Seduction of the Innocent, which I talked about on my first episode of this podcast, just for listeners. So, and that's the notion of like sadism. Mm-hmm. What kind of work do you see your writing doing to recontextualize the kinds of ways we talk about sexual violence or the texts and how we think about harm, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, again, I think it's a lot of really trying to give the perspective from the person who has the harm being done to them. I think so often it's used, especially historically, abuse against women is a plot device. It's something that, look, this is scary, or we've got to really punish this woman, so let's, you know, beat her or sexually assault her. And it's like, that's horrible. And it's always been very frustrating to me when I've been watching like films and you can tell they're just like, oh, what other horrible thing we can do? Oh, we can sexually assault one of our female characters. And it's not a plot device. And this is something that a lot of people experience, and we use it as this plot device, as just, look, this is scary. And obviously it is scary. I'm not saying that it's not, but it is strange when it's used in this way, especially by male creators. And I think most of the time male creators who haven't dealt with sexual assault themselves, because obviously, you know, we're talking about women are more likely to be the victims of sexual assault, but men are as well. And I often get the feeling, you don't know for sure, right? But I often get the feeling these are not men that have ever talked to a sexual assault survivor, are not a sexual assault survivor themselves. And it's more just this like distant idea to them of like, oh, look, this is something terrible that can happen. And, you know, so that's very, very frustrating. And for me, as I'm writing, it's really about telling it from the perspective of the people who have survived it, and having it not as a plot device, but really dealing with the aftermath and the reality of it. And you know, not just the experience itself, but how much, you know, we still don't do nearly enough for trauma victims of any kind of trauma. We really just don't do enough to support people if they've gone through something. It's kind of like, okay, it's over, move on. And that's really not how life works. And so for me, it's really trying to deal with that aftermath and, you know, how can we move forward, you know, as individuals, but also on a societal level of how can we support people who have gone through this? How can we stop it to begin with? And, you know, really, really dealing with all of that rather than just being like, oh, let's do something that's scary. You know, I mean, again, it is scary, but that's, you know, it's a lot more complicated than that. And it really shouldn't be just a plot device.
Right. So just like you're shifting the frame to a different character, you're mm-hmm. also shifting it from the event itself, which is important to represent, I think, but your focus is more on the like after the credits roll, right?
Yeah.
And that's really interesting. Have you thought about it like that? Do you have any thoughts on that? Like how those two things interact?
You mean like just shifting the frame in
yeah. yeah.
You know, I, as we said, you know, earlier, I just feel like we tend to get the same perspectives over and over again in everything. But, you know, if we're talking specifically about horror, it tends to be the same types of stories, and really trying to shift that frame from characters that we don't normally hear about and perspectives we don't normally hear about, to me, you know, one, it's a more interesting story because it's a story we haven't heard. So just from a very practical standpoint, it's like it's a new story that we haven't heard, or we haven't heard enough. But then also, I feel like it's a very important story, and the stories that we've been missing out on, and how that can really enrich our understanding of one another, just of people. You know, again, like I think it's like 1 in 4 women have been the victims of sexual assault. That's a huge number, and like people don't talk about it. And something that frustrates me a lot is on juries for rape. Like they usually are like, you know, any juror who knows somebody who's been the victim of sexual assault cannot serve on the jury. And I'm like, everyone knows a victim of sexual assault. It's just whether or not you're compassionate enough and empathic enough that someone told you. So it always frustrates me, because what we end up getting is on these juries for rape cases are people who just aren't very empathic. I'm going to be honest, because it's like, you know somebody who's the victim of sexual assault. Every single person in America does. That's it. You just know somebody. And so if you're on a jury and you're like, oh, I don't know anybody, that just means nobody trusted you to tell you about it, or you didn't listen. And so it's very frightening to me that that's like how we even run the justice system. And it's very much to me about kind of making people aware, you know, somebody, if they haven't felt that they could trust you to talk to you about it, then that's something about you, you know, that you're not being open enough that people feel like they can discuss this with you. So it's frightening. The world is a frightening place, right? It's a scary place. That's why we like horror, isn't it?
Yeah. So to bring us back again to comics, another trend that we see in comic scholarship, and horror scholarship in general, is this presumption that the audience is all young men. Right. I mean, even Carol Clover, who coined the term final girl, has a kind of section at the beginning of her book where she talks about like, well, I don't know if there are women, but the only people I talk to are young men. Right. Or something to that effect. Yeah. So how do you feel about that kind of assessment of audiences? And also, what was your experience with horror? Like, when did you get into it? What brought you in? And how has that gender dynamic played out for you?
So, I mean, I think there's absolutely every bit as many women as men in horror audiences, maybe even more women, right? I think it's kind of the opposite. And I also don't think it's just young people. I mean, I love Carol Clover, by the way. I love her so much. I was so excited when she got the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Stokers. But I do think that there was, at the point that she was writing that book, the idea that that was the case, but I don't think it ever actually was. That was just more of the people who kind of we saw as being the audience for horror. Even though if you would even see like old footage of test screenings from like horror movies, it was always men and women, right? Like it was always both. You know, I feel like there was always this idea that women were just getting dragged to horror movies by men, but I'm not saying that's never happened, right? I'm sure that's happened. I'm sure there's been men who have been dragged to horror movies by women as well. But, you know, it's a much more, you know, even mix of people, of men and women and non-binary people, like everybody. I feel like horror is very much appealing to lots of people, to everyone, really. And so, yeah, I don't necessarily agree with that. And I don't think that plays out, especially now that we're on the internet more, we can kind of see that there's a lot of female horror fans. For me, I've been into horror since I was a kid. Both my parents were really big into horror, so I just grew up with it. You know, my dad was a huge Poe fan. We watched Hammer horror movies and Universal horror movies. So it was like, we listened to Warren Zevon, you know, Werewolves of London, horror music, right? And so I feel like it's just always been there for me. And I don't know if like there was a point that I kind of realized that most people thought it was for guys, not girls. I don't know I mean, I guess as I got older, I understood that that was kind of a stereotype. But when I was young, it never really occurred to me. But I always was into weird things anyways. And back then being into like horror and Halloween was like weirder in the 80s and 90s. I was born in the 80s. So it was like, I feel like back then it was more like, oh, that's just a weird thing to begin with, whether you were male or female. So I just was more like, oh, I'm just into weird things. And so I didn't really necessarily think about it from the gender perspective until I got older. But I'm trying to think if anybody ever said anything to me about, oh, that's for guys. I don't think so. But I was pretty hardcore into horror, so I don't think anybody would have. And so, plus, you know, by the time I got to be a teenager, I always looked so goth. And like, once you look goth, everybody just assumes you're into that stuff anyways. So it's not like, you know, it's like, okay, like she's just a weird goth girl. So that's just what she's into. So yeah, I'm not sure like if that ever was, I was aware that people thought it was more for guys, but it never really ended up playing out for me. I was, you know, I didn't like that there weren't like more female characters that had agency in some of the movies, but you know, with slashers, there is at least the final girl, like you said, and I did always find that really appealing. So as I've gotten older, I've kind of had more and more of an issue with it, because I don't like the idea of one person having power or the other women, and even the other guys getting punished if they don't do the right thing, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I still love the idea of the final girl, but I do think that, you know, it's more complicated as I've gotten older, my relationship to that kind of trope.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to spend some time talking about your archive at Pitt. I think one of the most striking things for me and other people like who've interacted with it that I've talked to, other researchers, other like students working on these collections, is the kind of process-oriented nature of what is in the collection. So could you describe in whatever detail you'd like, your writing process, where do you begin? How do you proceed? How do you know when you're done? That kind of thing. And start anywhere.
Yeah, I sometimes feel like I don't have a set writing process. So whenever somebody asks, I'm like, oh no, I feel like I should have a better answer. And I don't know that I do. You know, a lot of it is, you know, that sort of idea phase is very amorphous for me. It could come from anywhere. It could come from an image. It could come from a movie. It could come from a song. It could, of course, come from literature as well. You know, it could come from, you know, a color or an object. It's just anywhere it could start. And then kind of going from there. And what I often find is it's this very dynamic, very almost subconscious idea of like, I might be, you know, watching a lecture on one topic that seems completely unrelated and then reading something else. And then they sort of start molding together and coming together in this very unusual way that I wouldn't expect necessarily. And then from there, really, it's a lot of just notes and seeing, you know, what direction I want to take it. And then the first draft, which is always, I do some mentoring of other writers. And I always say that that first draft is not going to be good. It's going to be very often it's very overwritten. I always say that, like, it's just there's way more than you need in a lot of cases, and other things that you do need that aren't there. So it's kind of like I always say first drafts are a mess. And so, you know, kind of having that first draft that it's like when it's done, I'm like, okay, this isn't great, but this is at least a good kind of skeleton to start, you know, building on from there. And then for me, I feel like most of my best writing does happen in that kind of editing process. And, you know, up until the editing, it's much more, like I said, a very subconscious experience for me. It's kind of very, you know, free flowing. It's very random, chaotic. But then when I get to the editing phase, it's much more like, okay, now it's like, now I've got to-do lists of what needs to be done. Now I've got this very, you know, I'm kind of going through it like almost like a business person looking at an Excel spreadsheet or something. It's not necessarily as creative, but I'm really getting down to what needs to be done, because I can kind of see more of what's going on and trying to get it to hit more of the plot points if it's a longer work. I don't necessarily worry as much about specific plot points in short fiction, because I feel like it's a more kind of open form. Like it can be just an idea. It can just be a scene. It can be anything, you know, whereas a novel could be, but a lot of things I would say that I would do, like even gimmicky things in short fiction that I think can be fun, and longer fiction starts to become tiresome for readers and even for the writer. Sometimes I'm like, you know, I write a lot of second person, you know, short fiction, and I love it. I love reading it. I love writing it. But I don't know that I'd ever write a novel in second person, because I think, you know, I'm sure there's some good ones out there, but I think that can get tiresome very, very quickly for readers and even as a writer. And so, you know, my novels tend to have a little bit more specific form than my short fiction does. And so that also kind of indicates, you know, where I go with the writing process. But yeah, a lot of to-do lists. I think you guys have some of the to-do lists in the archive of like, all right, here's all the things I need to do now.
Yeah. And I was actually, my next question was kind of about one of those lists, the kind of resounding winner or favorite in the archive is a list of overused terms. This is the one everyone I've talked to is like, that is, yes, that is me. I need to do that. That is brilliant. Thank you for giving me the idea, that kind of thing. Right. And I think that people who do any kind or level of writing find it resonant because that's part of the stream of consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. Is you're reusing a lot of the same language.
Yeah.
So I wonder though, what you might consider for yourself an emblematic piece of your archive, and something more general that you, or in terms of something more general that you produce kind of every time you write something or every time you write a novel or a short piece or, you know, something that if you had to pick one item that represents your process, what is it?
It probably would be one of the to-do lists. And honestly, the overused word list is probably a good choice for it because it's like, I'm working on my next novel now. And like all over the margins are all these words that as I'm going through, I'm like, wow, I've used this word a lot. And like, at least sometimes when there's something like look or stare, they're not great. That's not excellent, but like you can get away with that. It's my favorite is when it's like some really unusual word and I use it 3 times in 2 pages. And I'm like, wow, I really like that word that day. That was like a word that was on my mind. And it's, you know, those are really noticeable to readers. I think, again, like I said, like, if somebody keeps staring or somebody keeps smiling, sometimes you'll get a reader's like, they need to stop staring and smiling so much. But a lot of times you can get away with kind of more normal words, like everyday words, I would say. But it's the unusual words that like make me laugh when I go through. Make me laugh very ruefully, I should say. And ruefully is sometimes a word that I overuse because I love it so much. It was probably on that list because I do love that word. But like, yeah, I will laugh ruefully at the fact that I'm like, use that word a lot this time. I don't know why. You know, now I got to find a synonym or just completely change the sentence. Because that's, of course, where you have to go with it, right? Like either you find a word that kind of communicates the same thing, or you have to rewrite the whole sentence into a different sentence. If it's like, okay, I can't use just glance. I just used glance and stare and look. Okay, now you got to do something else. That's really at that point at the end when, like I said, I'm like a business person with an Excel sheet or like a to-do list. I do love to-do lists in general. Like every day I have like little index cards for all the things I'm going to do. I love them. It feels like I can have I actually can measure what you're doing, right? Because like, I feel like in the arts, it's hard because there are times you could write all day and you end up with fewer words than you started with. And that can be really, really good. But at the same time, it can be very frustrating because you're like, what do I have to show for it? Less than I started with. And hopefully it's better, but it's still, it can be kind of frustrating and it can be hard to measure it. So it's always nice to have a to-do list. Like I crossed this other thing off. So yeah, so I'm a big to-do list person. So I do love the to-do lists, and those are probably pretty emblematic of my process. I'm glad that the overused word list was something that people liked. I think that that's funny. I also thought more people did that. That's also interesting that people don't do that.
That kind of structure, I think, is really important, and the kind of thoughtfulness comes up in your work. It's very apparent that you are taking care with it. Right. Mm-hmm. And that your work is very lovingly produced, if that makes sense. Okay. One of the things that I really noticed in your work, and I've found that I'm really drawn to this story, is Bluebeard as a kind of folk tale, but also the notion of focusing on Bluebeard's wives. So I guess the question is, why not Bluebeard's wives? And do you have an idea for like what you would do if you did tackle that? Because it's been kind of done recently. Mm-hmm. But I'm fascinated to know what your take would be if you don't mind giving away too many trade secrets.
I am very fascinated by Bluebeard. I actually did write a short story. This is kind of a spoiler, but it's in an anthology from Weird Punk Books called Stories of the Eye, and it's called Her Skin, a Grim Canvas. And it's, again, spoiler, because it's kind of like revealed sort of halfway through, though you can kind of, you know, I don't mind if you can kind of see where it's going like a little bit. Like, I'm okay with that roadmap being there to begin with. But it's actually from the perspective of like a fashion muse. And Bluebeard is like a fashion designer, like this kind of weird avant-garde fashion designer. And all the previous muses are the basically like the previous wives. So, and that anthology is like a really neat anthology. I love the editors of it. So that was just a really great experience all the way around. And I would love to do something even longer with it because I've always been fascinated ever since I learned about Bluebeard, which was very late in the game. I think I was in my 20s before I'd heard Bluebeard, but this pirate with a similar name, isn't Blackbeard a pirate? Like, I always got confused as a kid. I thought they were both real people. I don't know. And it's sometimes hard to know with fairy tales where they came from, because sometimes there might be a basis in reality for some of them, but then sometimes like, no, there really isn't, you know. But I remember being confused when I first heard about Bluebeard and thought it was a pirate. And so then when I was in my 20s and read Angela Carter, then I'm like, okay, not a pirate, a fairy tale. Okay. And that was really when I started kind of getting into fairy tales a lot more, is when I read Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber. I actually read The Company of Wolves first for a literature class in college. And from there, learned a lot more about her work. And that was when I was like, okay, this thing with Bluebeard is like really disturbing. And you can see how it has affected culture, you know, and it's in a lot of different stories. So there's kind of echoes of Bluebeard and in a lot of work, but also just this idea of kind of using up women and being done with them, even if, you know, maybe it's not murdering them per se, but just kind of the using and discarding of women and how much that's like a motif that gets repeated throughout the world. Like I said, in the fashion industry, in acting, in a lot of things with women. Like, women feel more disposable to the world than men. Like, you know, women get older, or women, you know, if you aren't as successful right off the bat, men might get more chances, but women don't tend to get more chances as often. And so it's like, it's frightening how much that's a fairy tale. And it's obviously, you know, not, you know, there's, I think some of them even have supernatural elements to them. It doesn't have to be supernatural, I guess, you know, it could just be literal, but a lot of the versions do have supernatural elements, but, you know, it doesn't have to be. And that kind of idea and that motif of just discarding women is very frightening. So it's something that I think sadly does resonate with a lot of women, especially women who, you know, are ambitious and do want to be able to do, you know, as much as they can with their lives. And I think that's most of us, right? Most of us want a life that, you know, is our own rather than just one that's like, okay, you're just going to be a wife and mom, just stay at home, don't do anything else. And, you know, obviously there are people that I could be happy with that, and that's fine. And that's part of their identity, and that needs to be protected as well. But, you know, I feel like does hit at that kind of anxiety that I think a lot of women have of having our identity taken from us and just being discarded, like, you know, like we're very much, you know, nothing. And so, yeah, it's definitely a story I keep going back to, and I'll probably write about it again at some point, but I do have that one story from, you know, kind of a retelling.
So to close us out, what is your favorite piece of horror media, literature, or just generally cultural production? Could be poetry, could be an art piece, and why? So something you're a fan of recent, or a thing that keeps coming back to you in the middle of the night, right? Or just the most resonant thing that your brain kind of returns to, unbidden or otherwise.
You know, probably be We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson. I feel like I always give this answer and people are probably like, oh, she's going to give that answer again. But it's just, I love it. It's a weird kind of horror. There's, you know, suggestions of the supernatural, but maybe it isn't supernatural. There's a kind of whimsy to it, but it's also very dark. I love that. I think that horror too often is just treated as, oh, it's just slasher. And obviously slasher is fine, but like there can be this idea that it's just blood and guts. And I love the kind of horror that does have these other elements. And I feel like Shirley Jackson could do whimsical horror so well, and then she could turn around and do something that's so psychologically terrifying or supernaturally terrifying. And I love just the breadth of her work, just how many different types of horror that she did without it ever usually being blood and guts horror. She was not that kind of writer usually. Every once in a while, you'll get something in one of her works though that's really, really like kind of stops you and it's like, whoa, that's intense. But most of the time it is this quieter kind of horror. And so that I really love. And if I had to pick another one, it would again be The Bloody Chamber. I was literally just reading The Earl King aloud to my husband last night. And so it's like, it sits on my nightstand and it's like, I just love Angela Carter. And I think The Bloody Chamber, people talk about it, but I still don't feel like people talk about it enough. I feel like both We Have Always Lived in the Castle and The Bloody Chamber, they're loved, they're beloved. I know they are, but I feel like they could be loved even more because I think that they're so brilliant and really very female-centric stories that kind of give this perspective from characters that maybe you wouldn't normally hear from. Again, going back to, you know, the things that resonate with me, it's interesting to me, and I just love those types of stories, that it's not necessarily the kid, it's not the final girl. It's great to have the final girl, but I like the idea of characters that maybe wouldn't be the one that would be the final girl, but we're still hearing from them. Although maybe Mary Cat Blackwood is kind of a final girl. I mean, she kind of created her own massacre, right? But she did survive it.
All right. And so with that, I want to give a resounding thank you from myself and our audience to Gwendolyn Keist for being with us today and talking about just all things horror and gender and writing. And this has been amazing.
All right. And with that, thank you all for listening and have a good summer. Have a good next year and the rest of everything, and have a good day. Bye.